This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, November 4th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. It's been an unsettling week for Democrats. In Virginia, which Biden carried by 10 points in 2020, the Republican candidate for governor, Glenn Youngkin, defeated the Democrat, Terry McAuliffe. In New Jersey, Democratic Governor Phil Murphy was narrowly reelected in a race that he was expected to dominate. Meanwhile, in Washington, two bills central to Biden's agenda, a bipartisan infrastructure package and a $1.75 trillion bill focused on social and climate spending, remain in limbo, largely due to two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who have opposed several iterations of the bills. At a press conference at the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow on Tuesday, President Biden was asked about Manchin's refusal thus far to support the social spending bill.
Number one, I'm not going to talk about the specifics of my conversations. He will vote for this if we have in this proposal what he has anticipated, and that is looking at the fine print and the detail of what comes out of the House in terms of the actual legislative initiatives. I believe that Joe will be there.
Susan Glasser, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the current state of the Democratic agenda as post-Trump Republicans shape a strategy for the 2022 and 2024 elections. Hi, Susan. I'm so glad that you are here to help us make sense of all this.
Well, it's great to be with you, Dorothy.
The Democratic Party is predictably engaged in what one article called the circular firing squad phase of election postmortems. We're very familiar with this phenomenon. Moderates are blaming progressives for dragging the party too far to the left. Progressives are blaming moderates for not yet delivering on promises made during the 2020 campaigns. Where do you come down?
Well, you know, look, first of all, there's nothing like a good blame game. You know, that is a part of the American ritual of elections. One thing that's interesting to me, actually, is that it's both Democrats and Republicans who are very divided on what the meaning is. What should they take from this really poor, even than expected, Democratic performance in both Virginia and New Jersey? You know, you can blame one bad outcome on a loser candidate, on a screwed up campaign. But you really can't blame what happened in New Jersey on Terry McAuliffe having a bad answer in a debate, right? So clearly we're observing something of a more national phenomenon. And Democrats are facing significant trouble. What I've been struck by the last few months is how many Democrats were sort of in a state of denial about the perilous political position of President Biden and of their party. And so I suspect that this will be in the nature of a wake-up call for many of those who've lived within a sort of comforting blue bubble of feeling like, oh, gee, we have forever to hash out our, you know, progressive fantasy dreams. And sort of, you know, that's the problem with this very polarized politics, is that it becomes rarer and rarer the instances where one side is forced to reckon with the fact that the other side still represents a very large chunk of the country. And, you know, look, Virginia has not elected a Republican statewide official in a dozen years. So this was a very, very loud message to Democrats. The question is, what message do they receive from it?
But the Democrats did notice that they noticed Biden's big drop in popularity over the summer. And we, you know, various reasons are cited: the chaotic withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, the economy, the continuing COVID crisis, and Biden promising too much too soon about his Build Back Better plan. Is that it? Or is it also because these were fairly typical results in an off-year election?
No, they weren't typical. I mean, you could say that it was predictable that Democrats might have a tough time, because that has been the history a year after a presidential election. But the bottom line is turnout was up in Virginia, And what's interesting is that Terry McAuliffe, the losing Democratic candidate, got as many or more votes than the winning Democratic governor in the last election. The problem is Democrats were not nearly as motivated to turn out as Republicans. And you saw unprecedented, really, turnout for an off-year election among rural conservative voters in Virginia, even approaching presidential election year levels. And again, interesting for the state of national debates over what to make of Donald Trump and is he still a factor or not, Glenn Youngkin, the winning Republican candidate in Virginia, actually received more, a higher percentage of Republican votes than Donald Trump did.
Yeah, and he Youngkin, it's interesting. His campaign is kind of Trump with a friendly face, but also the way he successfully kind of stoked fears about critical race theory. You know, we've talked before on this program about how CRT was unearthed by conservative activists specifically to stoke this kind of panic. I'm old enough, and perhaps you are too, to remember the culture wars of the 1990s when Republicans seized on family values to attack Democrats on these issues like abortion, homosexuality, feminism, pop culture, and education. At that time, there were big debates over how schools should teach American history too. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the culture wars then and now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's an important point. This is not the first iteration of the culture wars. And I would say even before the 90s, you know, go back to the 1980s, that was certainly part of the new conservative base under Ronald Reagan. The Reagan Revolution, in many ways, was the permanent institutionalization of the culture war as a facet, in particular, of conservative national politics. But I was just having a conversation with Amy Walter, the editor of the Cook Political Report, right before our discussion. And, you know, she made the point that while this was the obvious backdrop and it was, you know, talked about almost constantly on Fox News, on talk radio, if you looked at Glenn Youngkin's ads, he did not mention the term critical race theory. If you looked at his ads, he talked about schools. We are almost 2 years into a pandemic. There's nothing that upset and outraged parents of, you know, young children more than the disruptions to their school life and that, you know, the horrors of Zoom schooling. That's an issue yes. that really resonated with the suburban parents who were a crucial voting bloc in the state of Virginia and in many states across the country. Youngkin's ads, again, could mean critical race theory to a hyper-activated, hyper-partisan Fox News watcher, but it can the school's rhetoric can also mean to a suburban parent in Virginia, which had one of the longest lockdowns. Many parents never sent their children into in-person school in Virginia the entirety of the former school year. That can mean a totally different issue. And I think the bottom line, Dorothy, is that you know, culture issues alone can't dictate the outcome. But when you have a president of the Democratic Party who is dealing with the headwinds of an approval rating in the low 40s, you're dealing with polling numbers that show that something like 70% of Americans right now believe the country is on the wrong track. And, you know, you ignite the right issue for people in that kind of a political context. And, you know, you do have an advantage if you're the out party.
I also wonder just quickly whether there is anything to the fact that in school board elections from Connecticut to Wisconsin, voters rejected candidates who opposed critical race theory. Is there any reason to think that hammering on about that might not be the silver bullet that Republicans seem to think it is?
Well, you know, it is a good question. I mean, again, I think it depends on the makeup of the individual state or district you're talking about. So the fact that we're having this conversation about New Jersey and Virginia, which are the two states that had elections, you know, those are eastern states with a pretty large population of educated suburbanite middle-class voters. Now, Virginia, unlike New Jersey, also has a very large rural and geographically dispersed voting population as well. So it's seen as a kind of a blue state, but that's kind of misleading because it has a number of very, very large red areas that can be critical in a statewide election. That's not true of all of the competitive states that will be on the ballot next year in the midterm election. So I think you can kind of get misled and sort of say like, oh, what works in Virginia is going to work all over the country. That's just, I don't even think it works all over Virginia, frankly.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So getting back to these massive spending bills, it's almost impossible to keep up with the back and forth and all the changes day to day. But maybe you could just bring us up to date as of Thursday morning, where things stand now.
Well, one of the things that we're talking about, right, is not just what happened in these elections, but what lesson each party takes away from these elections as far as politics. And for a group of Democrats, the big message received is we've got to deliver. We failed to deliver. We should have had the vote before the off-year elections. We've taken too long. It's a party negotiating with itself. And that undercuts the central premise of Biden's presidency, which was that, you know, a return to normalcy, meaning a return to showing that government can actually get things done and deliver for people. And so I think that, you know, that is a big chunk of the party has certainly read that message into what happened this week. You had actually both Democratic senators from Virginia, Tim Kaine and Mark Warner, strongly coming out and saying, you know, essentially you guys here on Capitol Hill are responsible for tanking Terry McAuliffe by failing to hold votes when we were ready to hold votes. And so that has increased the pressure and the urgency on Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, to move these bills forward. And so I think you are going to see the House go ahead soon and try to pass both the infrastructure bill and their version of the Build Back Better. That's the bigger social spending bill. Now, interestingly, that's a change in strategy because you still don't have sign-off from Joe Manchin, and you don't have everybody in the Senate agreeing. And so Nancy Pelosi made a unilateral House decision. I'm going to go ahead and stick back in the family leave provision in the bill, even though Joe Manchin has said he's against it in the Senate. So it's still, you know, it's never done. But
And here it is, Democrats, two Democrats in particular, as you just mentioned, Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, holding up the whole process.
Well, but you know, that's been a talking point, and I would like to challenge that a little bit. Like,
sure.
It's true that, and you know, Democrats prefer to frame it as though it's just two people and, you know, like it's the whole party against two people. If that was true, actually, we probably would have already moved forward. It's not true. In the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi needs to keep basically in unanimity in her entire conference as well. And there are groups of lawmakers, any one or two of which basically can sink the vote and have been negotiating because they themselves were not ready to sign off. Not just the almost 100-person House Progressive Caucus, which is the reason that the infrastructure vote didn't happen last week before the elections in Virginia. That wasn't because of Manchin and Sinema per se, although they'd like to blame it on them. It was the progressives. Now you have a situation where actually you have many members from the New York and New Jersey area who are saying that they didn't want to vote on the House bill unless it included basically a repeal of a return to the state and local tax deduction. You had many members who care about immigration saying that they aren't going to vote for the House bill unless it includes immigration provisions. And so, you know, that's the problem when you have a very, very expansive legislative agenda and you do not have a very expansive legislative majority. You know, you're sort of trying to do LBJ-sized things in a 50-50 Senate, but also essentially in a 50-50 House.
So as you say, Manchin and Sinema have been pilloried in the media for digging in their heels on these bills. But maybe what you're also saying is that even with the compromises already made, and there have been compromises, you know, some of the numbers have gone down and down, but these are still very progressive pieces of legislation. Is there anything to be said for Manchin and Sinema attempting to moderate them a bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's honestly, that's how politics works in this country. Yeah. I mean, I do feel like a little bit of this is like a lot of Democrats, especially in the House, but also in the Senate, who've never been in a governing majority situation, who don't seem to, like, you know, I'm not a genius negotiator, but are you really, did it really have to take this long when you start out with Manchin saying, well, I'm willing to go for $1.5 trillion, and Biden saying, and Pelosi saying, well, we want about $2 trillion. So is there anybody surprised that they split the difference between $2 trillion and $1.5 trillion and ended up at $1.75 trillion? I mean, that's how negotiations work. That's what politics is. It's not getting everything that you want at every moment. It's what you have the votes for. It's about making compromises.
So one of the mysteries here is that of all people, Biden knows this. How many years has he been in? Was he a senator? And he knows how politics works. But he did, as you have written, he put so much personal prestige and political capital on the line for a deal that for some reason he has just been unable to close with his own party.
Well, right, Dorothy. I'm really glad you pointed that out because, of course, that's the reason that you're seeing this take a toll on his personal approval ratings and his credibility and capital as a leader. That is literally what he ran on, was the idea that, you know, rather than a kind of a big, you know, BS guy like Donald Trump who claims to make deals and then never makes any deals, that I've spent my whole career in Washington, that I understand how the system works, that I know how to get things done, that I'm a creature of the Senate, that I understand about compromise. And he's talking about making deals with Republicans. Not only has he not made any deals across party lines, but well, he did make this infrastructure deal, but then he can't get it over the line, right? And so he can't even, he's been negotiating with his own party. And I think that is this kind of, you know, big kick in the stomach to the central premise of Biden as a leader and as a political figure. So that's why it's really important for Pelosi to move these votes through, as she seems once again to be intent on doing in the next few days.
One of our colleagues was asking in a meeting the other day what role Chuck Schumer has been playing. He's been, at least as far as she and I have been able to tell, he's been oddly absent.
Yeah, it's very interesting. This has been true really throughout the entire period where Schumer and Pelosi have both been the leaders of their respective Democratic caucuses in the House and the Senate. He's really basically been publicly overshadowed by Pelosi. I will say that, you know, Schumer, up until this crisis, and it is something of a crisis, has managed to keep his party quite unified, considering that they do have very different political situations back in their states and very different kind of ideological orientations represented, right? You know, you do have everybody from Joe Manchin to Bernie Sanders in one conference. That's not necessarily an easy group of people to wrangle, but it is really a notable fact how low profile Schumer is compared with Pelosi or even compared with Mitch McConnell, his opposite number among the Republicans.
This was also a big week for Biden in politicking abroad, where he made amends with French President Emmanuel Macron after a bit of bungled diplomacy. He met with the Pope and he affirmed his commitment to taking action on climate change at the summit in Glasgow. How was he received in Europe, sort of overall, and how worried are our allies about his reputation at home?
Yeah, I think these are really important questions. There is a clear understanding, especially among America's European allies, I think now after the Trump years, of the connection between America's ability to play a leadership role internationally and its extreme kind of gridlock and dysfunction in our politics internally, that has profound geopolitical and international consequences. And, you know, first and foremost, right, there's the question of what good is the word of the president of the United States if that policy and that presidency are just going to switch the policy in a couple of years, right? We make an Iran nuclear deal, we blow it up 2 years later. We join the Paris Climate Accord, we withdraw from it, then we rejoin it. What's to stop us from withdrawing from it 2 years from now? Second of all, there's simply the question of, you know, what kind of consensus do we have in order to enact policies that would be necessary to make global progress, right? That we're so interconnected and globalized that decisions our Congress here makes or doesn't make are going to affect the economies of all these countries. They're going to affect the security of all these countries. And so I think there's a real anxiety now, a real sense that, you know, what happens in Richmond doesn't stay in Richmond anymore, never mind what happens in Washington.
Perhaps actually, you know, these bills will go through, although they have to go back and forth a bit more before they can make it to Biden's desk. What do you think Biden should be doing to counter what now seems to be a sort of hopeful, aggressive push by Republicans to build on Youngkin's victory?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think there clearly is going to be a lot of second guessing, not just about the fundamentals of politics a year into the Biden administration, but also about the messaging. I mean, you know, you and I sitting here today, and it's, you know, our job in part to follow these developments. And, you know, can we really tell you exactly what is in this gigantic social spending bill, and this is in and this is out? And, you know, how can an average person, you know, be expected to understand what is it that the, you know, Biden is delivering to the country? So they have a huge challenge in terms of communicating with the public about what exactly their agenda is. Right now, we've been talking a lot about whether it's actually going to move forward or not, the process of it. They now need to start in a very more compelling way, talking about what it is that they're doing and why it matters. I think infrastructure, they can pass that. By the way, the Senate did pass it. And so if the House does pass it, Biden would be able to go ahead and sign it. Whereas the reconciliation bill, especially if their provisions are very different, that could take longer. But, you know, the infrastructure money, can they get it flowing to the states? Can they get actual projects being built in time for the midterm elections next year? You know, infrastructure spending is generally very popular. Donald Trump kept talking about doing it. In fact, he actually talked about doing a bigger infrastructure bill. That would be something, I think, you know, that would be meaningful to voters if they could pass it and get projects going, get, you know, people out there building things.
Thanks so much, Susan.
Dorothy, it's great to be with you.
Susan B. Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on Biden's Washington. She and Peter Baker are the authors of The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James Baker III. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.